Good morning. If you're joining us online today, this is the Senate Finance Committee. We're in room 532 in Juneau, Alaska. It is 9:02 a.m. and we had a snowfall, if anyone's interested. So Juneau is digging out from under a little bit of the white stuff. With me this morning in Senate Finance is co-chairman Senator Kelly.
Good morning.
Good morning. Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and Vice Chairman Senator Michicki. Today is Wednesday, February 11th, and we are here to have a presentation from first Alaska Aerospace Corporation and then followed by the University of Alaska. If I could invite Mr. Craig Campbell and President Pat Gamble. While he has two different titles with us today, if you could each introduce yourself for the record and the capacity that you're presenting today.
Be glad to, Madam Chair. My name is Craig Campbell. I'm President and Chief Executive Officer for Alaska Aerospace Corporation.
And I'm Pat Gamble, President of the University of Alaska System, and I currently hold the position of Chair on the Alaska Aerospace Corporation Board.
Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
We have a presentation PowerPoint ready to go just for everyone's benefit. The Senate, we need to depart here by about 10:30. We have a floor session that begins at 10:45. We'll be hearing from our judicial system and our Chief Justice a little bit later. So if we could keep the presentation and conversation to no more than 40 minutes and hopefully the official presentation somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30, that would be helpful with the committee's support, obviously. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, we'd be glad to do that, and thank you very much for having us today to do an overview of Alaska Aerospace. The last year, especially the last 6 months, has been very dynamic for us across the state. We recognize the fiscal challenges that Alaska is facing, and we're looking at how we can help be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So I hope today, as I go through the presentation with my chairman, that you'll see that we've got some innovative ways to change Alaska Aerospace. I think I'll answer some of your questions about the accident that occurred in August, our rebuild, and some of the stuff that we're doing, and the way forward that I think you'll appreciate. So if you don't mind, I'll run through the slides first and then be open for questions. So 2015 budget changes. We have a new launch contract. We are under contract with MILTEC for a second launch of the failed mission for August. Do not have a date yet for that, but we are under contract for that, and that is partly why we are aggressively working on a rebuild of the launch site today. During the year, we also did complete a contract with Blackbridge for global imaging distribution. Blackbridge has a constellation of five satellites in space, rapid eye satellites. They're in polar orbit and they image the world, and they're very unique in the way they do that. They're the only company that basically can give you the full coverage of Alaska without cloud cover, but to about a 95% assurance in a year's period. So we're the distributor of that imaging data worldwide now. We last year took a $2 million reduction in our budget. That was 25% of our budget for general funds, as you remember. And our plan was to go reduce another $2 million this year, but I'll talk about that when I get to the 2016 budget. Last year, we deleted three vacant PCNs, and we did some other cost savings inside Alaska Aerospace so we could be on budget with the reduction that you gave us. We opened a virtual office in Huntsville, and what I mean by virtual is I'm not renting space there, but I do have an individual who's on contract who lives in Huntsville who's worked in the industry for about 30 years, has very good connections with both NASA and the Department of Defense, and he's representing us in a lot of the work we're doing in developing a new business market with the Huntsville market. And finally, we received $2.4 million in deferred maintenance funds last year, very helpful to us in being able to do some basic renovation work and fixing things that haven't been worked on in years. We until 2 years ago had not received any deferred maintenance money, so some of our facilities were getting in need of repair, some security systems, lighting systems, communication systems, roofs and stuff. So this was very helpful. So we move to 2016, to the budget highlights, and you see a lot more listed there because I'm very excited about this coming year and going to be asking your support of the budget requests that the governor has presented. Because with the state's challenge of the budget, the governor asked if we could get by with going to zero on state funds this next year. And that's a $4.2 million reduction for operations and sustainment. We looked at it and we concurred with that. So we are in concurrence with the governor's budget to reduce our general funds by $4.2 million. One of the things you'll see come through, though, I think the budget as it initially came out also reduced our overall budget from 11.2 to 7.2, or maybe it's 11.7 to 7.7, but it took the same 4.2 out of the total budget. And I've asked that we be allowed to still have a budget authorization of $11 million, but that the 4.2 will be shifted from general funds to error receipts. Therefore, what I have to do is I have to earn that money. It's not coming to the state, but it gives me the authorization to go earn that money. So you should be seeing a change come out of OMB just with asking that the total budget be raised, but that the 4.2 and GF still remain at zero. We also returned $22 million in capital funds for the appropriation of medium lift. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in the future. You authorized $25 million earlier this year. Towards the end of last year, we actually notified the governor's office that $22 million could be returned for reappropriation use or savings because we were not going to be using that for medium lift. In 2016, we're going to complete the facility rebuild with insurance funds, and I have a slide talking about that, about the incident and about the rebuild. We are going to complete the Launchpad 3 environmental assessment. That was the medium lift new facility that we had initially started. We are complete with the work that we are doing on the EA. That's a FAA, Federal Aviation Administration environmental assessment, and they're about ready to issue their final determination on that. We are asking that the executive branch allow us to use the remaining $3 million for medium lift to allow us to make modifications to Launch Pad 1, the existing launch pad, so we can accommodate medium lift, specifically the Lockheed Martin Athena 2S6 rocket that would be able to launch from Kodiak with some minor modifications to our current facility. I do not have an answer yet from the administration as to whether we will receive that authority, but we have asked for that approval. And we are in the process of working with Lockheed Martin and Arctic Slope Regional Corporation Federal Side and the University of Alaska in developing a very aggressive aerospace integration complex for the state of Alaska that would diversify our economy. And that will be a separate subject we talk a little bit more about in the coming months. We're not asking for any money to be placed against that. It's just going to allow us to do some things pretty innovative that support a number of different programs, the F-35, the F-22, long-range radar, unmanned aircraft systems, the Athena-3, a whole bunch of different things that are going on in our state and consolidated into a center for Alaska. In 2016, with our original budget of reducing $2 million, we reduced 10 additional PCNs by taking the additional $4 million out of GF, but not reducing our overall budget, therefore allowing me to have the 4.2 as error receipts. I will not be doing any other anticipated PCN reductions at this time. We do plan to expand that Black Bridge satellite imaging services from distribution of the data to also downlink. We're in discussions with them right now to provide the services that would allow us to actually downlink the data from the satellites into Alaska, and then we do the sales from Alaska. We're looking at expanding our commercial launcher capabilities. We have a couple of customers that do have a different type of system that are interested in using Kodiak. And we are going to take our RSTS, our range safety and telemetry system, and start providing range services at other airports around the country with that. And that will be a revenue generator. And finally, we want to initiate transition of AAC to a privatized non-state company. And that's probably the footnote stopper I want you all to focus on this slide. We've had conversations with the Chief of Staff, Jim Whitaker, and we've been working at how would we take Alaska Aerospace and keep it of value to our state. I do not believe shutting it down is a good decision. I think that would be a bad call because there's been a lot of investment there and there are jobs and a lot of opportunity for our future. Shutting it down sends the wrong message. I do not think that an outright sale at this time would generate significant revenues. It probably would not even recover the cost of the investment the state has made to date. So what we are looking at is starting a process to privatize us, which would take us as a non-state company, allowing us to create value that sometime in the future would return the value that the state expected in the first place from Alaska Aerospace. So much more to talk about. This has just been a concept we've been developing the last week or so. I've been working with the executive branch to kind of determine what the boundaries are, and I think we're in agreement that a privatization plan is the right answer for Alaska Aerospace for the future.
Campbell, we do have just a point to make. We're trying not to use acronyms here because each department has in the state or each enterprise agency develops their own set of acronyms. And so just for clarity, when you talk about reductions in your budgets and PCN, if you could explain to the public Because we talk in FTEs, PCNs, yep. and other language. And then I know that most people know that when you referenced ASRC, that that was Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, but the PCN conversation first, so the all of us understand specifically what you mean to control your budget.
Madam Chair, yes, good reminder, because the PCNs are, of course, personnel control numbers. It's people. It's a position of personnel we have in our company. So we'll be reducing those 10 personnel positions. And there's a footnote for that also. We do not, with those 10 positions, intend to have layoffs. We have a couple vacancies this year that were created. We've had a couple resignations, and we have a number of retirements that have been pending. So our intent for those 10 PCNs, those positions, is to reduce them without doing layoffs. However, for full disclosure, if we get into the privatization discussion, that may change as to how the company is organized. But I can't tell you what that looks like yet, because we're just starting that discussion of what privatization would look like.
Are there any questions to this point from committee members? Senator Michicki.
Yes, through the chair, thank you. And thanks for being here. What has anyone expressed interest in a partnership or a purchase of the facility from the private sector to date?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, no. There's been no interest in anybody purchasing the Clear Contracts Complex or Alaska Aerospace.
Follow up, please, Madam Chair. You guys kind of travel in some pretty tight circles, and I'm sure you've had some discussions. I mean, have you seen any excitement sort of generated on some of the possibilities, or does it look like that would be a very difficult option on a partnership at the facility that would reduce the state's cost and investment going forward?
Through the chair, Senator, I have not had any expressions of interest. I think the aerospace industry is very small in the United States, and from what I could tell, if you're looking at the Lockheeds, the Orbitals, the SpaceX, the Blue Origins, and the basic handful of companies that are doing it, none of them are interested in owning a launch complex. There are really only four in the United States right now that launch rockets to orbit, and those are Vandenberg, a federal facility in California, Cape Canaveral, a federal facility in Florida, Wallops, NASA, which is a federal facility but has a small component for two launch sites that are run by the Commonwealth of Virginia and the Kodiak Launch Complex. And there's been no interest from others that they would want to convert any of those into a private operation at this time. So what I'm suggesting with the privatization is probably going to be a hybrid where the company is divided out so that the operations side can go develop business that utilizes Kodiak Launch Complex, and then as a package at some point in the future will determine whether there's value in any significant interest that could make it a return to the state that is worth selling. Okay. And I think that's, I really, Madam Chair and Senator Michicki, I think that really is a longer term proposition, and our assessment is if you actually just put it on the market for sale, you'll be very disappointed at what you get as a response. Now I'm going to try to do this again without blowing it up. Okay, Madam Chair, on to some of the background slides. Our August launch was with the Space and Missile Defense Command, and as you know, after liftoff, the rocket was destroyed. The fourth bullet down shows you that the command owned the rocket and the payload has done and completed their investigation, and they found no fault with the Kodiak Launch Complex. It was clearly part of their system, not ours. So to relieve anybody's concern that maybe we had done something wrong, the investigation report shows that we were cleared. There were some damaged facilities. The estimated damage cost is about $29.7 million. That is fully insured. There's been some question about where that money's coming from. It's not through an appropriation request of the legislature, and we have been paying into the state insurance pool since we started, and we've turned around now and put a claim against that insurance, and the insurance is working very well with us to provide the funds necessary to rebuild. Our rebuild should be completed by October of this year. Medium lift, that was another controversial topic towards the end of last calendar year. The legislature gave us $25 million a couple of years back to provide medium lift at Kodiak. There was interest of Orbital Sciences and Lockheed Martin to do medium lift. At that time, they were going to be fairly large rockets, the Antares rocket for Orbital and the Athena 3 for Lockheed Martin. When the legislature provided us the $25 million, it was gated into three phases. You can see the phases there, $3 million for design work, initial work, $10 million for infrastructure work once we had a contract signed with the company. And then the final $12 million would be spent towards the construction once we had financing, because the cost of the facility at that time was estimated to be about $125 million, and the $25 million from the state was only going to be the first phase of the of providing some of the funding towards it. So we would have to have raised at least $100 million more. Over time, it did not materialize that either Orbital or Lockheed were able to find that that type of financing would allow them to sell the rocket to be profitable, copying from Alaska. So we were seeing other movements in the industry, whether it was SpaceX or the Falcon, whether it was some international rockets that are of the smaller size but still have the ability to launch a medium-sized satellite. So in September, we decided to put out a request for proposal and to basically ask the world, is anybody interested in launching medium lift from Kodiak, and how would you do that? And we have $21 million that's available should you have a proposal that we accept. Proposals were received. We interviewed a couple. We had four proposals submitted, and we interviewed two companies. And on December 12th, Lockheed Martin was selected for the Athena 2 F6 model. It's a larger than the Athena 1. It's more like a Minotaur, the size we do today, but it has an increased payload capability. I think I have a picture coming up next, and you'll see that the weight of the payload is increased because they add additional engines to the bottom of the rocket, which gives it the medium capability, and we can do it from the existing launch pad. Therefore, we only needed to use the $3 million of Phase 1. We did send them a letter of an intent to award. On December 26th, the governor issued AO-271 and included the Kodiak Launch Complex in one of the six projects that he wanted us to stop work on. We had that reviewed as to which project that meant. It was determined that it is the medium lift project, so we advised Lockheed Martin that we were not going forward at this time. We advised the governor that we would comply and not move forward. We returned the $22 million, and we have now asked the governor for approval to go forward to use the $3 million to complete the medium lift for the Athena 2S. More to come on what the answer is. So here's the picture, and this is an artist's rendition of what an Athena 2S would look like on our existing site. We are on hold pending approval of the executive branch to proceed, and the picture shows the story. It's a thin rocket, but the payload's fairly large. The fairing is a lot bigger because it holds more weight and more size. And around the bottom, you'll see the strap-on rockets that add the boost capability to make that rocket able to put the weight into a polar orbit. I've already talked about the environmental assessment, but that is done for a new launch pad, and basically the whole process is complete. We've had the public comment section, we've had the review, it's with the FAA right now, and we're expecting their determination within the next couple months. The geospatial imaging data distribution contract that I talked about, that's our first step in diversifying the company away from just paying rocket launches. One of the problems I think we created for ourselves was only focusing on launching small rockets from Kodiak. Alaska Airspace, if you look back at the statute, was not intended to be a Kodiak launch complex. That certainly is one of the things we can do, but it was not designed that Alaska Airspace would be the Kodiak launch complex. We're supposed to be doing aerospace development. We're supposed to be working with the university. So this is the first step of allowing us to diversify into an ability to sell market stuff, and then to take the next step, as you see towards the bottom of the slide, to possibly get into a contract to download the data from the satellites, and then when they do their new generation, which will be a few years out, they're going to be launching a new constellation of RapidEye to actually be the launch provider for that system as well.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, back on slide 9. On the bottom, AAC has a potential customer interest, et cetera. Is the customer interested in underwriting the entire cost?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, we have a potential customer that it wants to launch from Kodiak at some time in the future, and we have not discussed how the finances would be arranged. So I can't tell you whether they expect us to pay for it, whether they expect to pay for it themselves, or whether there'd be some collaboration. That's a future discussion.
Would it be your goal that they underwrite the entire cost?
Through the chair, my goal is that we privatize Alaska Aerospace and we no longer come back to the state of Alaska requesting for work to expand our business.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Bishop, did you have a comment?
Just a quick comment. This is kind of intriguing, this Black Ridge option here, maybe that might be forthcoming, because I'm getting a little bit out of my zeal, getting a little bit ahead of my knowledge here, but thinking back to DGGS and the state and mapping, there could be some synergy here.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we're hoping there is. The Rapid Eye and Black Ridge has a very good product. I believe the state is going to be purchasing or is in the process of purchasing some of their product. It would not be with us. It was a previous purchase. But that's what kind of stimulated the Alaska Aerospace to see they had a good product that works for the state of Alaska and will work for anybody working in Alaska, private industry as well as government.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Please continue.
We're also tracking the Dragon capsule that is launched to the International Space Station. We've tracked all five of its previous missions. They had a mission just a couple weeks ago to the International Space Station. We tracked that, and as they go forward in the future, we'll continue tracking the Dragon capsule. So we are using our facilities, even though it's not launching, not front page news. We are using our facilities for things other than just rocket launches from Kodiak. The range safety and telemetry system is what we use to track launches from Kodiak. As you know, we went 3 years without a launch. That system sat at Kodiak without being used. We have no launches for 2015, so we'll sit there for 2015 with no launches. This is a mobile piece of equipment that can be used anywhere in the world. So we have started to take that unit and talk to other providers of range services that provide services at a number of other locations. Excuse me. And we're working with two different companies right now on discussions as to how this system could be utilized at other locations and create some revenue for Alaska Aerospace when we're not using it at Kodiak. We can't have that type of multi-million-dollar equipment just sitting around for 3 years. It's not good for the equipment. It needs to be utilized, and we should be making money from it.
Senator Olson, did you have a comment?
No, I didn't. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Watching microphones, I apologize.
We also have taken an initiative on the international side, which is really new for Alaska Aerospace. We've talked to the Japanese and we've talked to the Israelis about both the Epsilon and the Chevette rocket. We hired a consultant that basically identified the fact that those three rockets listed at the bottom of the slide, the Epsilon rocket from Japan, the Vega from Italy, and the Chevette from Israel, are all solid fuel, small launches. All three are looking for commercial opportunities. All three are launched from their native countries. But as they expand the commercial market, they may need additional range capability. So we are entering discussions with them about the potential of using Kodiak as an overflow facility should the commercial market expand to a level that they cannot meet their capacity at their own country. I don't want to advertise this as, oh, this is our savior, we're getting lots of foreign launches. I do not believe we will. I think we will get very few. But if we can get the established relationships so that we are an overflow facility, we will be able to generate some income by having international operations.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy.
Yeah, Chair, just quickly, 80% of the U.S. commercial satellite market is launched overseas. Why is it such a high percentage?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, the United States has been exceptionally good at raising the cost of launch to an unacceptable cost to the commercial market. We utilize Vandenberg Air Force Base and Cape Canaveral as our primary launch sites. They're federal ranges, primarily using very large rockets. The commercial satellite industry has changed, and it's having much smaller satellites now in the commercial business for both imaging, communications, navigation, weather. And we don't have the capability in the United States with those type of facilities to meet the cost that they need to launch and make a profit. So they're going overseas to get those. And that's why we're looking at the Vega and the Epsilon, because they're lower cost rockets. And if we can attract them to Kodiak, then the commercial satellite company is getting the low-cost rocket at a low-cost launch facility.
And are these overseas launch sites, do you know if they're the majority are private or are they government-owned?
Through the chair, they're virtually all government-owned.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Dunleavy.
fact, Madam Chair, I'll actually clarify that. They are all government-owned. Lastly, we've been working on unmanned aircraft systems for a number of years. Previously, we were always looking at the Global Hawk. That's the picture that you see up in the upper right-hand corner. It's a very large, it's almost a 737 aircraft-sized unmanned aircraft system, very expensive to operate. We've gone through an extensive study of the market capability of that in Alaska for us to do as a private company and determine that just is beyond what we financially could handle. We would not make money operating Global Hawks from Alaska under in today's economic climate. But we are continuing the unmanned aircraft systems working towards a smaller size. And we are one of the, we are partnering with the University of Alaska on the UAS Pan Pacific test site that's being done by the university. Kodiak is one of the test locations that's identified there, and we're working with the university very closely on how we would commercialize UASs with Alaska Aerospace being a partner with the university in that commercialization effort in the future. Now, I want to go back a couple more slides now on money because, you know, I've read in the press, you probably have also, a number of people allege we've never made any money, and I'm not sure how I understand that. If you look at our balance sheet over the last number of years, if you take out depreciation, there have been a number of years when we actually did make money. 2012 is when we ended up in the real problem. We've never come to the state before for operations to save the money until 2012 because we operated for over a dozen years with our, on our own cash flow. So here's the composite picture as of June of last year. Federal grants, 43%, $150 million. Launch revenues from the service, we have 17 launches, $146 million, another 41%. State investment, $58 million, 16%. Now, I'm not saying that's not a lot of money. $58 million is a lot of money, and I'm very appreciative that the state helped us go through that down period when we didn't have launches. But I don't think it's fair to say, but because of that, we never generated money. We generated almost $300 million in straight money, and all of that, of course, has a multiplier. This last launch we did in August down in Kodiak, as an example, about $250,000 was spent on rental cars in the area, and close to $1 million was spent on hotel and restaurant sales in a 90-day period at Kodiak because of those launches. So we have been generating money. We are a company that is capable of being a revenue generator for the state. The last few years have not demonstrated it very well, but I just wanted to show this to recognize that we're a pretty good company for Alaska to have.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, what would be your corresponding operations and maintenance cost?
Again, please.
Corresponding operations and maintenance? What are those costs?
Through the chair, annually, right now, our operations cost for the payroll of the salaries of the people and for electricity, utilities, and rent runs about $6 million a year.
Senator Dunleavy, any further questions? Any other questions from committee members? Senator Machicki? No.
Well, I have a question for later, but I'll ask it now, if you don't mind, Madam Chair. I'm a big fan of your facility, but in the interest of just kind of actual costs right now, I mean, with the SMDC August failure, it's kind of interesting that the launch Kodiak launch complex is not at fault, but the entity launching the rocket was not responsible for any damage to the facility. So are both parties held harmless contractually in a launch agreement?
Through the chair, Senator, we're receiving our rebuild money from the insurance company. I really don't know whether there's going to be any claim against anybody else or whether it's held harmless or not. I think you'd have to ask risk management.
For clarity for the general public, then, aerospace continues forward, and our own internal risk management will be making a claim with the federal government and trying to resolve issues from an insurance company perspective, something like your car. You don't deal directly item to item with the person that you crashed with. The two insurance companies talk to each other, and you go on. Is that an accurate?
Madam Chair, that's how I understand the process is working.
So
Madam Chair,
it's on my list also.
I have a follow-up and sort of relative to that, but you know, if $29 million comes out of the state insurance pool, what are the impacts of that and future costs to the state? Surely that changes the risk profile moving forward, I would think.
Madam Chair, Senator Machicki, I probably shouldn't I don't know. I think through revenue and risk management, that the discussions of how what we negotiate, what the cost of insurance can be in the future is best answered by them.
Senator Machicki, I think you raise a great question, and on the committee's behalf, we'll generate a letter, unless you'd like to pen it yourself on behalf of the committee.
Madam Chair, I have one just follow-up, and that is when we talk about revenue generated, and we may have a different definition of generating revenues, and I don't mean that disrespectfully by any means, but are launch fees sufficient to cover the state considering the risk of a launch failure?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, yes. I generate from the charges we do for a launch, we make a profit. And it covers our ability to pay for insurance, pay all our costs to back to the state for our fees for each year. So a launch is a profitable operation. We just need more.
Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy?
Through the chair, just some clarification. So in the maintenance and operations, you said $6 million. That's your costs? I mean, that's just the maintenance, that's the operations, but including the maintenance?
It's M&O? Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes. That includes the cost of payroll, the cost of our electricity to run the sites, the lease costs for our offices, administrative fees that we pay to the state. Our costs right now at the size of our company, we have about 40 employees, is about $6 million.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Bishop? Did I see you, or are you okay?
Senator Machicki, you got it. That was a good question.
Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left.
I'm almost done.
Okay.
State of Alaska funding snapshot. This is just a recap of where we are. You commonly gave us $8 million in 13, $8 million again in 14. We received the launch agreement with Miltech at that time. Received $6 million this year that we're operating in, and we're growing to zero next year. We support the governor's budget request. This reminds you, if you look basically on the center column, on the top above the blue line, you'll see the FY15 governor budget request, $6 million. You'll see the FY16 governor request, zero. And if you go down to our all other funds, you'll see last year's budget was $10 million total, and we are asking that it be $11 million this year. So the difference of the reduction of 4.2 would be moved into error receipts. Federal funding, we have been working the last 3 years very hard with our congressional delegation to get federal funding to support the aerospace operations of non-federal spaceports. Very quickly, the top bullet says it all. Federal government provides nearly $1 billion in operation sustainment for the federal ranges of Cape Canaveral and Vandenberg Air Force Base, and they provide zero for the non-federal spaceports. Yet, the non-federal spaceports launch for the federal government. So we've made the argument that for equity purposes, if the federal government expects a launch facility to be available for them to use, they need to provide some funding. And the appropriations committee in the 2015 omnibus bill put $6 million in to be split between Wallops, the state facility there, and Kodiak. So we're anticipating somewhere around $3 million to come to Alaska later this year from the federal government. And in conclusion, basically, I appreciate the time to be with you today. This is an exciting time for Alaska Aerospace. I made a commitment a number of years ago when the board asked me to be the president and CEO that I would change Alaska Aerospace, that we would not operate the way we have in the past, that we were not going to be dependent upon state dollars, and we were going to create a diversified aerospace business. I'm a little about 2.5 years into the mission. You've seen diversification. You've seen that we have reduced our state requirements down to zero now, and we are now taking the step to look at how we privatize the company and still keep it of high value to Alaskans. I'm very pleased to be leading this company. I'm very pleased with the board and my chair, Pat Gamble, who's next to me, on the leadership they're providing, and I just ask for your support of our budget request.
Are there any further questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Just through the chair, Mars, NERS, who owns that facility?
The Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport is owned by the Commonwealth of Virginia. It is co-located with the federal NASA Wallops facility.
Thank you.
Any other questions? to my committee first. I've been tasked to generate a letter to receive additional information on the insurance claim, and so we'll pass that out once we get it. Is there anything else that I should be asking or generating on your behalf, or if you're going to do it individually, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure the public knew that we were going to follow up and look at that that risk portfolio with risk management. Senator Dunleavy.
Chair, no. But I have another question, but it's no comment for what you just said.
Senator Dunleavy, your question.
Sorry. Just trying to understand, when the rocket that launched was destroyed by those on the ground watching the whole operation. So it wasn't an accident, per se. But is it commonplace that every once in a while there are rockets aboard it, but it doesn't necessarily take out the facility?
Senator Chair, Senator Dunleavy, very interesting question, because if you look back at history, most of the failures probably happened a lot further away from the launch facility than happened with our experience in August. However, about 75 days after ours, the Antares failure happened at Mars. They were launching to go to the International Space Station. It was almost identical. It barely got about 500 feet above the launch platform before it had an engine malfunction and came straight back down on top of the facility. So I can't give you probabilities or figures, because I'd say it doesn't happen that often, yet within 75 days it happened twice.
So was it a failure and a decision to take out the rocket?
Through the chair, we have a range safety and telemetry system there, and that system tracks the rocket from the time it starts its liftoff. And there are safety boundaries, and if that rocket is to exceed those boundaries or even head towards exceeding those boundaries, it's normally destroyed by actually a federal official. It's called the Mission Flight Control Officer. It's called a MFCO, and that individual has the destruct authority for a rocket. And so in this case, as the investigation identified, it was not a payload problem, it wasn't a rocket problem. It actually was the blanket that was around the rocket. When it peeled off, it caused something to happen to one of the thrusters, which caused the rocket to swerve and go off course. The MFCO saw that and destroyed the rocket.
Thank you for that clarification. Chairman, in your capacity with aerospace, Chairman Gamble, do you have any comments that you'd like the committee to consider? You've been listening. We'd appreciate your any brief comments that you might have about the Aerospace Corporation.
Well, very, very briefly, in speaking with the chairman's hat on, the board really has two roles. One is to hire and fire, and the other one is to figure out what the future is, what the vision for the future is. Without resolving the commitment of the state, we don't know what that vision of the future is. Is this just a business deal? Is this just an annual budget deal? Or is this Alaska, an aerospace state, who is investing and committing and growing across a wide spectrum of aerospace investments? I think that resolution needs to become more clear, and when it does, then the issues of risk, then the issues of investment, then the issues of organizational construct, whether it takes on a role of purely private, in which case it has a fiduciary responsibility as a private corporation as opposed to the state, where the fiduciary responsibility goes toward the stakeholders in the state and the state population as a whole. Much like the railroad, there are models that we could consider and that the board would consider. This initiative about going private is the newest one and the latest one, and that's the one that's getting the attention, but that's not the only model that could be in our future, especially depending upon what the legislature would like to see considered. So I would say that the vision right now, in fact, the attitude of the board is there is more potential going on right now with regard to our future than in the entire 18 or 19-year history of the site. Once again, the uniqueness of Alaska's geographical position has a lot to do with that. The explosion of commercial space just in the last 5 years or even less has got more focus coming into, as was described in the briefing, coming into Alaska and our ability with a very low-cost, rapid turnaround launch capability that we have. We look very attractive to a number of customers. So right now, the board is looking at, it's almost like, forget those sunk costs and forget the years when it was just a single payer, the federal government, and look at it almost like a startup that has a great product that has demonstrated its ability to its customers to be cheap and reliable, safe and attractive. We have a geophysical position here that is unlike the other three launch sites that were mentioned. And so when it comes to the question of who needs who most, we have a plus in that category because for polar orbits, we're it. The West Coast site at Vandenberg can launch polar, but there's a price they pay, not only the federal government's price, but a price in terms of fuel and be able to maneuver. We don't have that problem here. So a smaller rocket and satellites are getting smaller. We're looking at systems. The world is changing with regard to commercial space and with regard to smaller, smarter, more effective, and we're right smack in the middle of that. We're at a very interesting point, a crossroads, in terms of the people that are looking at us committing. Now, we mentioned Lockheed. You know, Lockheed, essentially, if we sign a contract with Lockheed, that's a huge commitment in terms of launches from what customers they would bring. Polar launches are going to come out of Kodiak. So it's not like we have to go out and look for every single launch one at a time. Our view is we're going to have a customer suite. And if you look at aerospace in the other locations where there are launch sites, once a main customer comes in and begins operation, these clusters form. And also, they break the trail for other smaller, less capable companies who will look at their experience and who will come in and either partner with them or they will come in and want to settle down into Alaska themselves in some way. So as a startup, we're at that bend in the curve where it's been fairly flat, and then all of a sudden it takes off. And we're right there in that bend in the curve. So what we need to do is get through the next couple of years. That's the most important thing right now, is get through the next couple of years, and we either make it or we don't. But we have never had a potential like the board is seeing this potential right now. And I would mention that our board is made up of some very wise people with regard to the space business. We've got an astronaut on our board. We've got a legislator on our board from Florida who was very involved in the Patrick site and launches out of Florida. A number of great board members, including the university and our space physics. So I'm a real fan at this particular point, but I'm really concerned because I know what you're about. You are about a budget problem in FY16, and that's a soda straw look at one facet of what I consider would be a much bigger question with regard to are we an aerospace state, and if so, is there a way to invest at the same time you're cutting back in areas that have less value? And that's the discussion that the board will have with Craig with regard to the privatization issue. Is there a market out there? Is there a customer out there? What will that customer expect and so on? So with that, Madam Chair, I would give my full support to the idea that let's get through the next couple of years, which the legislature had agreed to in its original game plan, a decrement of $2,000 a year to zero, and then a decision at that point, we either make it or we don't. That was a good plan, and we're riding that right now. Craig's gone a step further. He's going to propose to the board, you know, that we go ahead and zero out now instead of waiting for another 2 years to follow the legislative plan. That's kind of like preemptive surrender to some board members. You know, you say, well, wait a minute, you know, not so fast. But we've got to do what we've got to do, just like you all are having to do what you have to do. And we want to work with you, but from a business perspective, is it possible to invest at the same time that you're cutting back and reducing? And I think absolutely the answer is yes. And with a major customer like Lockheed Martin, I think we're on pretty solid ground at this point.
If I might, because I know that that it's when we're talking numbers, it's easy. I say millions when I mean billions, especially when we're working at shortfalls. So just for those listening, the budget issue that we're facing is both FY15 and going forward in FY16. And then I believe that you said 2,000, and it's $2 million that Aerospace has been cutting from their budget the last few years. Senator Machicki.
Mr. Campbell, I know you and I trust you, and I know you've done a good job, but I just have a question. I have to cut to the chase. You're asking for keeping $3 million for the medium lift investment. You're asking for $4 million in operating. Is there an oversupply of launch capacity, and at what point would you make the judgment call that the Kodiak Launch Complex may be unlikely to generate interest in the near future? And I guess the question, to really cut to the chase, is if not now, what would cause you to make the judgment call that it may be time to throw in the towel?
Through the Chair, Senator Machicki, first, just to clarify, I don't want the record to be misunderstood for what I may have said. The $3 million I'm asking for is already appropriated money. I'm just asking for it to be released. Basically, it's already in our budget for the medium lift. So I'm not asking for new appropriations for that. And the $4.2 million that I'm asking for is not state money. I'm asking for it to be just authorized so I can then get business and have the ability to receive the money through error receipts. So it would not be any state money. So for the 16 budget, basically Alaska Aerospace is asking for zero. Now, the next question is, when would we consider saying we can't do it anymore? I think that's a discussion between my board and myself that would result in the board coming to that conclusion upon me not being able to generate sufficient business to make them feel comfortable that what Chairman Gamble just talked about is going to happen. Right now, I can tell you I've got non-disclosure agreements with a dozen different companies that are talking, including the federal government, are talking about services out of Kodiak and out of Alaska. It's not all launch. So I'm very optimistic that this path that Chairman Gamble just talked about is real. We've hit the bottom. We are starting to come out. We've got Blackbridge is one example of one that came up that we've discussed. We've been able to conclude and it's going to expand, and there are others. So I think going forward, when I'm asking the state not to fund me, just to give me the authority to allow us to continue so the board can continue to see whether this is real or not, is a legitimate request. And I think the chairman put it best. We're not a state, we're an aerospace state. We understand our fiscal problem means the state can't be contributing money towards that today, but we don't want to have an image that we don't want aerospace business here. And I can tell you, because I've got my friends at Orbital and Lockheed and within the federal government who call me every time there's a blog on about shutting down Kodiak or the state's not going to fund us, that immediately they call, are you going out of business? We're talking to you. Should we go somewhere else? I mean, it has repercussions rapidly. So I think the honest answer is we are an aerospace state. I think we made that change, and the board is confident that we're on the right path, and I'd only ask that you allow them to continue that until the board comes to the conclusion that we can't, and I don't think they ever will.
Mr. Senator Machicki, do you have a follow-up?
I think it was an important statement to hear from you, and I appreciate the answer. I guess what I would like to clarify for the public is that the board is focused on either moving forward. You've got some smart folks on your board. At some point, you may come to the realization that although we are an aerospace state, we may have a difficulty drawing business to Alaska for launches. And I hope you succeed wildly. I certainly hoped that last year with my support for you. I just want people to know that we are at least focused with the realization at some point that there, if we don't succeed, we don't plan on dragging this out for the long term. So, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess refresh my memory as to what the vision was 10, 20 years ago when Senator Stevens stepped up to the plate and said, I think it was before your time, being intimately involved with the aerospace program out there, but what was the vision? Was it to go ahead and try and produce a profit for the state of Alaska? Was it to try and go through some intellectual exercise so that we can continue to write papers like university people do, and or was to provide a service for our society.
So, through the chair, Senator Olson, that vision has probably changed over time. Initially, the legislation, when it was first passed to establish Alaska Aerospace, was designed to tie us close to the university, probably to do business development, marketing, and maybe even the operation of Poker Flat. That changed fairly rapidly in the late 80s, early 90s, as our country changed, and Senator Stevens saw the need for missile defense and the capability of a larger launch facility that would need to go into polar and identified Alaska as that place. And so that vision changed from Poker Flat and really a university-type organization into an aerospace company that would provide the lift out of Kodiak for the federal government and commercial business, as well as providing other aerospace opportunities. We, Alaska Aerospace, ended up just focusing on Kodiak Launch Complex. In the mid-90s, the commercial market for satellites really collapsed in the United States because of the high cost of launch, and so that's when everything started moving overseas. So the vision to go commercial also suffered a setback. So we ended up being very dependent on just federal government launches. Our problem, our mistake. So going back to Senator Stevens' vision and really going back to the mid-90s, the vision is that we provide launch capability from Alaska for polar orbit, as well as providing a diversified economy in aerospace in other places other than just Kodiak. That's part of what the integration facility is that Lockheed and we are talking about right now, is the opportunity to provide some more business in Anchorage and then provide support work out of Fairbanks, especially with the F-35s at Eielson, with the long-range discriminating radar possibly going in at Clear. There's an opportunity now to take aerospace and diversify it into other locations across the state. And I believe that's what Senator Stevens really wanted, aerospace in Alaska, not just a launch site at Kodiak.
Senator Olson.
And continue, Madam Chairman, as I look at some of the other places like Vandenberg, the place on the West Coast in Canaveral, naturally I was a kid when President Kennedy went in and said we want to put a man on the moon. But as you look at these facilities, they're all federal facilities, and I guess I find it intriguing that there'd be a venture to try and go out there, but realizing that the U.S. government can print more money while we as a state are harnessed by the, and we're being handcuffed because we just can't provide that. And I realize that, you know, as has been pointed out, that Alaska certainly is there as an aerospace state, but I don't see us in the long run being able to afford to continue to be on the forefront of those of the space frontier.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, here's my observation in response to that, because your premise isn't wrong. We cannot afford to just live on the Kodiak Launch Complex and expect to have enough launches solely there to be a profitable aerospace state. It has to do more than that. Launches are part of the portfolio we should provide. And partly, since we serve the federal government, that's why we've been lobbying so hard to get the $3 million in the budget to cover some of the operations and sustainment costs of Kodiak, because if the federal government's going to use us, then they should be partnering with the state or Alaska Aerospace to make sure that facility is available. So to some degree, you're going to see us continuing with getting that baseline amount in there, that as long as the federal government has identified Kodiak as a launch facility for federal missions, they need to provide some funding for operations and sustain it. You'll also see our company diversify away from just launches at Kodiak. If we had one launch a year, and we had the federal funding, and we did diversified work with unmanned aircraft systems, data downlinking, and a few other things that aerospace could provide in the state, Alaska would be a very good and profitable aerospace state. We are getting there. That is starting to happen. So back to why Kodiak? Well, Cape Canaveral's in Florida, Wallops is in Virginia, but they don't compete with us. The only U.S. facility that competes with us is Vandenberg, a federal facility. And for a commercial operation to operate from Vandenberg is very challenging. We just had an example from SpaceX. They are operating large, heavy rockets out of Vandenberg. And they were scheduled for a launch, and the U.S. government then called them and said, well, you can't launch now because we have a national security mission that has to go, so you're going to be postponed. Well, for a commercial company to have a satellite postponed means they're deferring revenue. They need to have that satellite in orbit when they expect to have it in orbit because they've signed contracts with customers. We don't have that problem. When you contract to Kodiak for a launch date, you launch on that date. The federal government can't usurp you, and you do have that authority. So that's the value of Kodiak, a small niche. It's not going to be our mainstay, our only business anymore. It can't be. But it has a niche that's very valuable to commercial service in the United States.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. I would just point out for the committee that we're about 10 minutes into the university's time. Senator Dunleavy, you did have a question that you wanted to get onto the record.
Yes. Just very brief comment. The drastic price in oil has caused us to relook at things and tighten up our stress test for what is viable, what's not. And bottom line, and I'll just end with this, we've got to be able to make a decision. You have a board. We're one of your investors. People of Alaska are looking at this, and they want the economy to be diversified too. But what we're getting is we've got to separate our hobbies from our money-making ventures. And so we really are going to need to know when this crosses that threshold from a hobby. And I'm not belittling it by saying hobby, but in other words, when you have a lot of money, you can have a hobby. When you don't have a lot of money, you need some help in bringing some income. And if this is going to be an income producer, it looks like you're going to have to buck international trend, which they're all government-owned, and the ones in the United States. And so it'll be very interesting to see how that happens. I hope it happens. We need a diversified economy, but it's got to get out of the hobby stage and start carrying its own weight.
Madam Chair, there's very short responses. I agree with you. That's why we're going to zero funding. I'm not promising the future is going to be beautiful and wonderful and that I've got it all guaranteed, but I am taking the first step. Don't provide funding for us and give us some flexibility and allow the board to make some decisions to determine whether we're going to be able to do that or not.
Co-Chairman Kelly.
Yeah, I just want to say that I've kind of given this speech before on some other topics, but we talk about economic diversification, and this is it. And there are decisions that have to be made, and some of them are uncomfortable, and they rarely come at the time that you would want them to come, these opportunities to diversify. I just want to encourage the committee that we'll look back on these dark days, and we want to make sure that we didn't eat our seed corn, and I think this is some of our seed corn here.
Bishop.
I concur with Senator Kelly. Thank you.
We're going to, Ms. Campbell and Campbell, thank you so much for joining us today. I know that it takes time and energy to prepare for these types of things. I know that there are people watching. I certainly had a great conversation when I met with you all in previewing this presentation, so I thank you for your time. With that, we'll take a brief at ease, about 60 seconds to 120 seconds, so that we can, please keep it in seconds so that we can change out our displays. Good morning. This is the Senate Finance Committee. We have in place a president of the university system, Pat Gamble, and joining him at the table, Michelle Rizik. Welcome. Our next presentation before us is the FY16 budget overview. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is our briefing looking for $100 million to buy the Kodiak launch site. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's the next briefing. I'm going to skip through the first couple of charts. You all know our mission, and you know where we live. I want to put this chart up to show you that we're at a point of turnover right now at the university. Those positions that are in red, starting with the new board members at the top, four new board members, and then a fifth one will join us in May when the student regent, who is a voting board member, changes out. That's quite a changeover in 1 year for a board. And our board members are going to have their first indoctrination and update meeting this month, at the end of the month. But we have here in the audience John Pugh. John, in his many years at UAS, is going to be sorely missed, and there's a search committee that's working on that right now. The Vice President for Academic Affairs, who is sort of my right-hand academic person on my staff, that search process is down to four very highly qualified candidates. We did a national-level search. Tom Case at UAA has an interim provost, and again, the academic right hand. So you can see across the board, and then yours truly, there's quite a changeover going. And so one of the things we're looking for right now that's very important is, and you'll hear this theme in the briefing, is the importance of continuity to make sure that the things that we've got going that are actually working, that we started a couple of years ago and we're starting to get the data back that says it's working, are things that we want to continue despite the fact that we're going to have some major turnovers. The guiding principles that will allow us to do that is a document called Shaping Alaska's Future, which you're familiar with. And the themes in Shaping Alaska's Future, and this slide runs through, you know, just an overview of what that's about. That will not change. That is board policy, Shaping Alaska's Future, and the expectation of the board is that we will use it as a guide through this transition period. The budget briefing itself, normally we're briefing to you an incremental budget, and we're talking about the increments, but there are no increments. And then the capital program, as you know, is greatly reduced in terms of what came forward from the governor, from former governor. And so I think that the question people keep asking us this session is not what do you want or what can you take, but how are you going to get by? And so I think that's the focus I'd like to bring to the committee today, is a little bit about what's the methodology that we've agreed with our board to get us through what we see as a period, which is defined by us as about a three-year period. And then we'll take stock of where we are, or we'll readjust as more information comes to play in that three-year period. But we can't just look at 16, because what we do in 16 is actually going to affect, and you'll see this, affect us one, two, and even 3 years out into the future. And we've got to take that into account. So our strategy is to essentially take what we're doing right and take what the data is saying that we're doing right, the metrics that we established, and build around that. Focus on a core. You know, what are the core missions of the university? What are the expectations for offerings in the state of Alaska by potential students, by our employers? Recalling we're in the workforce development business very, very big time, and that's an important component of our strategy as well. We've got more and more data coming in places that we never had data before, so we're becoming more and more data-driven as opposed to having brainstorming sessions and who has the loudest voice, you know, wins the argument. The data really tells the story, and we're relying more and more on data-driven decisions, particularly data that shows that there is a direct relationship between the inputs that we're making and the success in the outputs. Much more of a focus on outputs than on process. Research is a very essential and important component of the university system, and it's important to the state of Alaska. Research doesn't just come from the federal government, although they're the predominant research funder at the present time. Research can come from the state. The state contributes money to research in areas that don't come through the university. We'd like to see more of those offered to the university to see if we can't do that for the state and do it more reasonably. And if we can't, then we can turn around and say, no, that's not one of our core research areas, and then the research can be done at some other location. So the core programs include the cultural scholarship and preservation. In our mission statement, we are the keepers of a large portion of the cultural preservation in the state. I don't see any of that changing with the budget situation the way it is. Those contributions, those dedications to our cultural responsibilities will be part of the balanced portfolio that we will end up drawing down to, and so I don't see a threat there. Community and industry partnerships. The industry partnership that's probably one of the most interesting is the one you all just discussed a few minutes ago. We talked about just a launch site, but we're talking about a corporate interest in Alaska that goes across a very large area. It's a page out of the state's book in diversification. It is a partner with Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. They want to hire Alaskans. They do not want to bring people out of Florida. They want our researchers to do the algorithms for their radar. This is a really good example of how partnership with the university can work, and we can go into more detail on that. We have a lot of good things that are going on right now. I'll tell you, this is a terrible time to have to go through a budget cycle like this, because the danger is we can go in and line item by line item something that has a title that we made up for the budget, but it really doesn't express maybe very well to the reader what does this really mean, and what are the linkages to this line item and other line items, such that if I cut this as a line item to save X number of dollars, I've essentially disabled the ability to do a couple of other things. When you get smaller and you shrink down around a core, the connections between programs they grow. More programs depend upon other programs for collaboration, consolidation, and so on. So snipping a connection in one area can actually have consequences that are unintended, and we're very sensitive to that. But having said that, we've got some outcomes that are going on now. And so it would make sense, it seems, from a logic point of view, that as we go forward with what we're going to be over the next 3 years and what we're going to end up being at the end of that three-year period, when our baseline is reduced over a three-year period, we want to collapse around the things that are working for our students that we've said all along we really need to have as a functioning, reputable university. And so we're looking at graduation rates that are coming up. Well, why is that? Well, we know what we're doing, such as advising, that it's contributing to retention. So those are the kinds of methods that we're going to use to connect output to what is it we want to collapse or contain in this core that we're talking about. Degrees and certificates, we have a list called First Evers, Best Evers, that goes way beyond this page right here. And we're looking at that list and looking at some of these examples and saying, to the greatest extent possible, these are the things that we really need to have in that core. Reputation is very important to a university. If you want to recruit faculty, if you want to recruit and competitively win research, reputation is one of those factors that's looked at. And we are growing a reputation right now that has us up in national level achievements that we have just simply not seen before in the past. And this is not over a long period of time. This is basically over the latter part of 2014 and already in 2015. The items that you see on this chart right here are coming in, and this is a rolling document, this First Ever, Best Ever, because we've even received one or two more since this page was published.
Senator Machicki has a question, if you could pause for just a moment. Senator Machicki.
President Gamble, I've just been in the oil and gas industry for 30 years, and I'm just noticing a growing proportion of Alaska-educated engineers, process tech folks. The product is impressive, and it's a very high proportion right now in the industry and state. I guess the question I'm going to get to is have we investigated the university system as essentially a profit center in being an international service provider, delivering that same level of quality around the world? And is there any potential to offset our in-state costs with some of those profits?
I would say that there's a great potential. We haven't unlocked that potential entirely. You know, in both UAA and UAF, we've set up a commercialization and intellectual property organization to be able to spin off that will allow us to take a share of profits that would come from the inventions or the research, the developments of a faculty member, for example, that would take that work, spin it off into a business, or we could sell the intellectual property, an algorithm, for example, to a company, and then a portion of that goes to them, and then a portion of it comes back to the university. There are great examples of other universities who have done a terrific job at that. We've just started, and the numbers are quite impressive in terms of the number of submissions for patents that we've not only filed for, but that we're being awarded. I think both universities now have received their first check back. I know I saw one for $10,000 presented to UAF as a result of startup company paying the university back for our share of our investment in the company. There's much more that can be done. The other thing that we've done in the past is that we have started up programs without knowing whether or not we will entirely break even with that program. In other words, out of a sense of obligation to a study area that may translate into workforce production of certain skills, we have started up programs and they haven't paid for themselves. In the current financial situation that we're in, we are now under a sort of a rule across the university that if somebody wants to start up a program, such as you might suggest, somebody comes in and says, can you do this? Our opening point is it's got to break even. It can't be subsidized because we can no longer afford with general fund money to subsidize anything that doesn't pay for itself. Now, that doesn't mean we go back to everything that we're doing with 500 different programs and go back and cancel them all because most of them are subsidized. But in the future, as we look to take on more programs and as we look to reduce programs, whether or not they pay for themselves and add value to a customer or to the state of Alaska is going to be the calculus. And that was not necessarily the case in the past. We were a growing university, and when somebody wanted to come in and have a program of study, maybe there were a small number of students, we said, sure, sounds great. We would find a professor and we would open up a program. Those days are gone.
Senator Machicki.
Thanks.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So the next slide, I've got what I call aim points. There are certain things about Alaska and about the University of Alaska that are our niche. And again, if we're gonna restructure ourselves smaller, we want to maintain the quality. We want to go into those areas where we are the experts, where the competition is reduced, where we hold a commanding lead or reputational lead in terms of our production in these areas. We call them our niches. Our geographical location adds to that considerably. We're like a big petri dish for a whole number of things, from the environment to the oceans to geospatial to volcanoes and on and on and on. So those are the areas then, particularly in research, where, again, we can't be all things to all people, but if we're going to do these things and do them well and get national recognition and maintain a reputation, even though we're going through some tough times, people aren't going to look at the university and say, well, they're down and out in their luck. Nobody wants to go there to work or to get a degree. They're going to look at us and they're going to say, boy, these folks are really good at what they do, despite the fact that the state's going through some tough times and they're having some funding difficulties. They're managing quite well. We want to come out the other end of this thing and grow like everybody else and not disassemble our talent in the process. So these niches are important. You can see the aerospace state. I'm a big believer in that. and these other ones that we talked about, the land grant initiative, I've introduced that here before in front of this group, and this year we're actually formally introducing it into the legislature.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if we could go back to the 10th slide. One that has received a lot of attention over the years is the tuition and fees and how to strengthen the core. You list balanced tuition and fees, and I wonder if you might expand upon that this year and in the future. What does that mean to the average student that's attending our universities?
Surely, Senator. Through the chair, when I say balance, I mean the balance, to balance them on the downside, not the upside. The tendency is to solve problems with tuition and fees. Policy in the university says a fee can only, the dollars can only go toward which the fee is intended. You can't take that as discretionary money and put it someplace else. But in terms of trying to solve all our financial problems with raising tuition, we're not the University of Washington. When they were cut over 2 years, they commensurately raised their tuition, the same amount that they were reduced by the government. It was a huge tuition increase over 2 years. We had the smallest tuition increase we had in over 10 years last year. We're looking at a small tuition increase this year, but the size of our problem is double what it was in 15 when we go to 16. But despite that fact, we're not gonna solve that problem on the backs of the students. By the same token, the students who are here and being supported by the entire university complex, who are here for 4 or 5 years, they've got to have a stake in this period we're going through as well, because all the services are going to them, and they're going to help us lift some of the shortfalls that we're going to have. What our commitment is, and I think it was very clear on the part of our board, the board originally wanted to have zero. But then when we started seeing the numbers for 16 come in, the board realized that that just simply wasn't possible anymore. 5% is not as low as some states have been able to do, but those states are putting money back into their universities. The ones that are cutting right now, the 5% is low because they're asking for considerably more tuition to be paid in other states across the country. So I think this is what I mean by a balance.
Senator
Thank
Hoffman.
You. Thank you, Madam Chair.
President Gamble, then, if I might follow up, could you tell us, as compared to other states, where we rank as far as tuition for our students?
Well, a good example is Western states. You know, what we call WECHE, it's the Western states group. If you look across the United States, it's kind of tough because the geographic areas are so different with regard to jobs and population and so on. So we tend to look at our competition and those states that are what we call our peers or the top-line universities in the West, and we call that the WECHE group. Our tuition is about 75% of the average of all the rest of those states. So we're 25% lower in tuition. Fees, I would say across the United States, in fees, we're probably no better than average, maybe a little bit below average in terms of total fees.
Thank you. You used two different criteria in your answer. So where are we then? You used on the fees, the entire system versus the other Western WECHE. States, the WECHE. I'm thinking of a board there. I'm sorry. Can you tell me where the tuition then sits over all other 50 states? If we're in our peer group, if we're 25% lower, where are we nationwide when we look at that number?
Okay, out of the 50 states, we're probably fourth from the bottom, I would say, in tuition.
Okay.
We used to be closer to the bottom. We're actually moving up a little bit, but there's a couple of energy states like Wyoming and North Dakota who are actually subsidizing more and able to reduce their tuition.
If I might ask, is it in your presentation any reflection on what President Obama has put out as a possibility for free community college, and how is that discussed in your presentation further? I just have a question on whether that will actually drive up tuition costs for students with an expectation that the general government or the federal government may be paying for that the loan that that student may carry?
That's a great question. I mean, we're very interested in seeing the details of that. We don't have enough details to work that out and bring it forward, but I, you know, we charge tuition at our two-year schools at the same rate we charge tuition at our four-year schools. That was a decision made way back when the community campuses were created. My goal, if there was a way in the world to cut that in half, if we were to cut that in half, we would then be right even with the rest of the two-year colleges around the country. That would be a wonderful goal to be able to do, and I think it would attract a lot more people in. So his program to offer free community college for 2 years is of great interest. What we need to know are, I thought I read where there was a match involved, and so we need to look at some of those details. But I think at this particular point, I would not want to badmouth that proposal from an Alaskan perspective, but we need to know more about it.
President Gamble, I appreciate that I wasn't trying to badmouth it. I think education is absolutely, just like you, a wonderful opportunity. My concern in this discussion is that if there is money and people expect that it's going to be free, won't that cause a rise in tuition because it will transfer the costs over to the federal government? And a student may take on that burden or that debt load maybe without understanding that they're still the ones signing on the dotted line. And because President Obama is supportive of this, that Congress may not be able to actually fund it. And so I'm just wondering whether there could be, and I understand, we need to know more about it, so I guess I'll leave it at that.
Well, I would say that, as we all know, nothing's free. It's going to come back to us one way or another, and there's quite a price tag associated with that. From an academic point of view, the thing that I would be interested in is I would want to make sure that somehow, some way, this contributes to a better graduation rate, because if it's just free tuition and nobody's graduating and we haven't improved the lot of the student going through the process, then I'm not sure what it's for. So there's a lot of really great questions out there, and I didn't mean to take the comment the wrong way, but I mean there's a lot of people who are just right off the cuff just saying, well, this is not a good idea. We're not in that group right now. We think we need to see more, but this has some potential to it for Alaska.
Thank you.
So the model that we've been talking about here is where can we generate revenue as well as eliminate cost? We talked about commercialization in the middle of this chart. We're talking about collaboration, consolidation, all those good things that we've talked about in the past. We now have a sense of urgency that, unfortunately, sense of urgency tends to drive things a lot better than when you're just trying to get out in front of a problem and nobody's particularly interested in changing things. We now know we have to change. We're putting that to good use. The collaboration between the three universities right now is just simply amazing. And we have a leadership group comprised of the leadership of all three universities on the academic and administrative leadership side, chancellors and the provosts. And when they speak with one voice, that really sends a strong message across the system. And we have been able to move forward on a number of initiatives that we've never been able to gain traction on before in years past. This is going to help us get through this next three-year period. There are some simple things we haven't had to worry about before. Control of energy use. You know, we've now been informed that the potential exists that for FY16, used to be that the state picked up a whole lot of the bill with regard to our utilities, and we've been told that we're going to have to pick up the entirety of the utility bill across the whole campus systems. That's going to be a significant add-on to our costs. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But talking about these investment opportunities in unmanned aerial systems, we've got people beating down the door. There's a lunch and learn today about unmanned aerial systems, and one of the things you'll hear about is the number of companies that want to come in and commercialize with us and partner with us, and these are money-making deals. And then you see the other things there. These are our niches. These are where we have advantage across the board. We're number one, in fact, you may have heard this, we're number one in articles with regard to the Arctic in the world from UAF, and the number of citations that cite those articles by other people, we're number one in the world on that too, internationally. So we've got a lot to be proud of, and what we want to do is make sure that we don't disassemble that with unintended consequences while we're looking at trying to save a dollar here and a dollar there. That's the work of the chancellors and the provost. It couldn't come out of my office alone, and this collaboration is key to our success. The bottom line is we want to look good to students. We want to enroll more students. We want to retain them through those first couple of years and then get them out the door with whatever they came in looking for, whether it's a certificate or a PhD. That is our mission, that's our role, and that's what we need to preserve, I think, for the good of the university during this period of time coming up.
We have a question. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a comment. You know, I just, you know, enroll and retain more students, and I cheated and looked over on the next page, and, you know, you guys are doing a great job because you're maxed out in some of your programs now because they're doubling up on space and split shifting, so good on you.
The challenges. There's lots of challenges. We don't have a definition of readiness in the state of Alaska for higher education. When you come out of high school, who says you're ready for college? Most states have a definition of readiness, and we've looked at them all. Some are long and involved. Some are very short, like Arkansas, that basically says when you can pass your freshman courses, you are ready for college. And if you can't, then the schools need to ante up and change their curriculum so that you are ready. That's the simplest one that we found. We're working with the state in terms of identifying what ready for college or workforce ready means. Somebody who can walk right into an apprentice program, for example, in one of the union programs. Those are great programs, and unfortunately, some of our high school graduates just simply aren't even ready at that level. So to do what we want to do in fisheries and in mining and on the slope, and get better at it, this issue of readiness is really important, because once we decide that, we can push that back down through the K-12 system and align ourselves, make it a K-20 system, and that's going to be of great advantage, I think, to students of all kinds. I've talked about the core. We need to stay positive in our message. The sky is not falling. This isn't the end of the world. We're going to go through a tough time. It would be nice not to have to, but we're taking the paycheck. It's our turn. We're on the job, and the expectation is we're going to make this thing work. And that's the word that's going out to our faculty and our staff. They're understanding that, and they're agreeing with it. They're not going to like to have to squeeze up when we pull people in from rented offices and put them into our office buildings and double up. That's not going to be pleasant. But those are the kinds of things that are going on literally right now, and people will be fine with it. You know, I came out of the military, and it was a soldier's right to gripe. You never wanted to take away their right to complain and to gripe, and I think that spreads beyond just the military. We listen to those because in all the snarkiness and the blogging and the stuff that goes on and the grumbling, there's always a gold nugget in there someplace that we hadn't thought of. And so we read those and look at them very carefully, and we're in the process of evaluating just about everything. We still have aging infrastructure. We haven't changed our number one priority in the system with regard to deferred maintenance. And we've got a little bit of deferred maintenance in the budget. If it stays there, that'll be great. Deferred maintenance has done wonders across the campus, as you can ask the chancellors. The spend out on deferred maintenance will probably take another year or so, and then with no more coming in, there'll be a great pause in terms of the contracting. But right now, we're still busy with deferred maintenance money. And we put our money to work as soon as we get it, as fast as we can turn it. I think the last bullet on this feeds on the conversation we had in the previous one. From a business point of view, the hardest thing is to figure out what to keep, not what to cut. The hardest thing to figure out is how do you continue to invest for your future when your year of execution in your budget is so severe. It's very, very hard to even want to have a conversation about investments that are going to pay back in the future. But in the business world, in the corporate world, and I think the state is business-like, that's an important consideration and one that should not be automatically thrown out. At least we have the conversations so that the unintended consequences aren't that we disassemble something that we can't put back together again. It would take years.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. The last two bullets bring up or remind me of three important programs, and they do provide services in public and private partnership through investments, many of them that Senator Machicki mentioned in science, but the other ones are in health. And I wonder how the university and the board view the and the future of ANSAP, WICHE, and WAMI in the context of the last two bullets.
In my opinion, Senator, personally, those are core programs. I mean, just plain and simple. I would, on my watch personally, argue very strongly that we are not at the point where we would want to disassemble programs like that. I think they're keen essential to not only doing what they do, but to the reputation of the university as a university system as a whole. And they do a wonderful thing for the state of Alaska as well, and we would miss them terribly if we were to lose them. So they, as long as I'm here, are not on a chopping block.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. If we could, the bells are calling us to the floor now, and we really would like to know, from a budget perspective, do you have an increase? Are you reduced, or is there flat funding anticipated under the operating budget portion of your program?
Okay, this last chart is a view from the university. This is not a view from the legislature. This is our chart. It's not constructed by Ledge Finance. Ledge Finance documents look at appropriating, and they look at it through that lens. We look at it in terms of how much money don't we have to spend in the budget year. And in this chart right here, as you can see, the arrow that goes up from former Governor Parnell's budget, if you look over estimate three-year impact for 16, what we're looking at, bottom line, is the bottom line down there. We're looking at about $43 million that we don't know where we're going to get the money to cover those bills. So that then becomes the target for cuts. We're going to have to, through the three universities and the campuses, find or reduce our baseline or some combination of revenue if we can produce it. We're going to have to cover a $43 million bogey that we right now don't know where we're going to have to come up with the money. That's the near-term problem. The long-term problem is if you look at the GF baseline at the very top under FY18, the baseline is going down every year too. So when we come out of this three-year point, we've got a long-term strategy problem in that that's all we're going to have to pay for everything that we've got at the end of the 3 years. And if it's longer than that, the baseline keeps coming down because we're estimating that we will continue to get reductions. And that's the essence of our briefing.
President Gamble, that's confusing to the general public because every other department presents a baseline budget from what the appropriation number was that the state of Alaska provided and the appropriation number to the next year. And this committee is interested in those numbers specifically. It goes back to the old red book, whatever we changed that, camouflage, I think, was in a past year, was what the book looked like. And so we truly need to see what you received last year to this year in making an evaluation on, for at least some, on where we would invest. This is what you've planned. We understand that the Board of Regents is planning to invest in programs, but we need the numbers as they affect whether it is flat funding, an increase, which I believe you did receive last year, but I'm trying to actually confirm that. Not an increase from your request, but an increase from a previous year's budget. So if we could get that information, that would be helpful. I do want to, Chancellor Pugh was not in the room when you announced him. He's been joined by also by UAF's Chancellor Rogers, so I wanted to make sure to acknowledge their presence. There's another question internally on your budget. You've shown quite a few employees or vacant positions or cuts to personnel. This committee is very interested in whether those are reoccurring costs that are actually dollars that are being removed from your budget or if they are if they're just positions that have been held in the budget from past appropriations. And so we are interested in seeing how many hard numbers are attached to the seats that you're telling us and positions that you're eliminating. And finally, I know the bells are ringing, but at the University of Alaska's campus, there's been quite a buzz in the news and other media sources about the closure of the child care facility. And I'm wondering if you want to make any comment or if it's been made and you're, I just didn't know. It's in the media and some people may want us to ask you about it.
Okay, if I may address those, Madam Chair. If you look at 15 on this chart, that's the first column. 15 was a 4.6% reduction that we took. We had to cover a $28.4 million total budget shortfall. That goes to 42.9, and then we're guessing for 17 and 18 that it's going to be somewhere like you see those numbers. That's the long-term look that we're looking at. So the reality is, when we come in and say we're cutting these programs, somebody says, well, why are you cutting those programs? What's the deal? I thought you were getting in only a 2% or a 3% reduction. The percentage doesn't mean anything to us. That number is what we have to meet by cutting those programs in order to drive it to zero so we can balance the budget. So that's why I was explaining the difference between the way we look at it. They do include the state's numbers. We just changed them around to make it look to our people so that we've got a bogey that they can understand they have to meet. It's useful for our communications plan as well. The numbers, I can tell you in round numbers, for example, out of 4,900 plus authorizations, 4,900 and some change, we're down to about 4,500 employees overall. That number keeps coming down. It's not going up. Staffs are coming down faster than anything else. We are reducing faculty. Some programs have already begun closing. Brian can talk to those privately and give you specific numbers. Some are associated with people, faces, if you will, pink slips. Some are associated with slots where we had intended to fill them, but we no longer intend to fill them. And then the last one about the Child Development Center, I'm preferring to let the Chancellor deal with that entirely as a campus issue. The board is well aware, as am I, but at this particular point in time, I think the issues are quite clear, and he's working with them through a number of meetings as well. The takeoff on that, I mean, old people and babies is not a winner when you have to go out in the public eye and talk about doing anything bad to them. So I don't envy him in the work that he has to do, but there's a logic back in there. The part that I think was missed was they're trying to find a solution to bed them down someplace where they can do this work. But, you know, they're not accredited. We haven't even been able to accredit them in that location all the way back to Fran Elmer's days. And to me, that's not good. I mean, I've run child development centers before, and not having them accredited is not good business. So there's more to the issue is all I'm saying.
Mr. President, I appreciate you and Ms. Rizik coming today, as well as the chancellors. We know that the services that you provide are very valuable to all people in Alaska. I do not mean to cut you short in an opportunity to speak to the Senate Finance Committee. We know that there are great needs. I would like to say that the committee will be meeting tomorrow morning, Thursday, February 12th, here in the Senate Finance Committee, room number 532. We'll convene at 9 a.m. We'll be taking up SB 27. It's an appropriations bill, the operating budget, loans, and funds, as well as bills previously heard. With that, we're adjourned.